From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The late Reverend C.T. Vivian was one of the most prominent activists of the civil rights movement. He started in the 1940s with successful sit-in demonstrations in Peoria, Illinois. Later, Vivian became a close friend and advisor to Martin Luther King. And in the 1970s, Vivian focused his attention on directly combating hate groups. He co-founded the National Anti-Klan Network, later called the Center for Democratic Renewal. But today, we're not going to actually talk about the full story of C.T. Vivian. Instead, we're going to talk about the story of a young reproductive justice activist who came to work for him, Loretta Ross. Professor Ross, welcome to the show. And let me just start by asking you this. C.T. Vivian once told you something that you said really changed the way you viewed your own activism. What did Reverend Vivian tell you?
Well, he came to the office one day and he said, when you ask people to give up hate, then you need to be there for them when they do. And when he first told me that, I didn't want to hear that message, but I couldn't curse at a minister, so I had to just suck it up and say, I'm not the turn the other cheek kind of girl. What are you talking about? Because if a black girl can't hate the Klan, who can she hate? But it sunk in, and that's what's led to me talking about the calling in culture right now. And he was right.
Calling in culture. Okay, but let me just ask you, though, before we get into deep detail about calling in, as you mentioned, when Reverend Vivian said that to you, what exactly did he mean by being there for people?
One of the services that we provided was to help communities deal with hate violence, and that was my particular job as a program director. But eventually my responsibilities grew so that I worked with Leonard Zeskin, who was our research director at the time, to help deprogram people who had been in the hate movement. Lenny would interview them, and then I would help them reintegrate back into society, because you can imagine when you choose to leave the Klan or the Aryan Nation, you've been in that netherworld so long that you don't really have any ease back into the society, into normal society. And so I would work with them. I got to know them. And of course, once I got to know them, I could no longer hate them. And so it really was an epiphany for me in my life when I really had to look underneath the rhetoric of what they were saying and pay attention to what was going on in their souls and their hearts. And they were really some troubled people sometimes.
Wow. Okay. So let me give everyone the full introduction to you now, Professor Ross, if I may. So Loretta Ross is a longtime activist, feminist, scholar. She's currently visiting associate professor at Smith College in the program for the study of women and gender. And we're talking with her today about her pushback against call-out culture. She teaches a course about white supremacy, human rights, and calling in the call-out culture. And I understand that a book by that same name, Calling in the Call-out Culture, is due to be published next year. So, Professor Ross, thank you so much for being with us on the show today. I want to spend a little bit of time for the remainder of this first segment really getting to know you, having our listeners get to know you better. But let me just first ask, though, what does, you know, your experience as a black feminist civil rights advocate, you know, you're talking about the Klan a second ago, what does that have to do with the digital calling out culture now that we seem to be surrounded by?
Well, I think that if a black woman can learn to have civil conversations with someone who's been in the Ku Klux Klan, we should be able to have civil conversations with everybody, because we have to remember that there's humanity behind the words, that there's humanity behind the action. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about walking up to the boys in the hood and saying, I want to be your best friend or anything. But at the same time, we can't dehumanize people simply because we disagree with their political perspectives. And I think I really started this work when I was much, much younger, when I was the third executive director of the D.C. Rape Crisis Center. And we had helped start a program called Prisoners Against Rape. So you had rape survivors going to Lorton Reformatory, which was D.C.'s prison, and working with men who had been convicted of raping and murdering women. And that was really my first effort at talking to someone, and talking to a lot of people, as a matter of fact, that I was scared of, that I didn't think I had anything in common with. And once I started sharing my story of sexual violence, and then the guys started telling their stories, like outside they raped women, but inside they were raping men. Once they started telling their stories, I found that I could see them as human again. And these Black men at Lorton went on to found the first anti-violence program run by men to end violence against women, called Prisoners Against Rape.
So this is important to note, because this isn't just an intellectual exercise for you, as you said. Like, this directly comes from much of your own life experience. You also, as if I remember correctly, I think when you were just a teenager, maybe around 16, you got tear gassed at Howard. Is that right?
Yes, I was fortunate enough to graduate high school at 16. I'd had a baby before then through incest, but I graduated college at 16 and went to Howard University on a scholarship. And in our dormitory, which was on 16th Street, Meridian Hill, there was a lot of protest in Washington, D.C. back then. And so we were in our dormitory. Actually, we were on the roof of the dormitory protesting and hollering at the cops down on the street because there was so much unrest. And the cops just turned around and shot tear gas canisters up on the roof to chase us back into the halls. But then the tear gas got into the halls and got into our dorm rooms. And that's my first experience at looking at state violence as it directly related to me. And of course, being at Howard University was a very special time, because that's where I learned about Black consciousness. Somebody put the autobiography of Malcolm X and Tony Cade's book, The Black Woman, in my hand as a freshman when I was 16. And I've been a Black feminist ever since. Mm.
So I suppose then, in the context of 2020 America, some folks might ask, well, then what is this powerful, prominent Black feminist doing, or what was she doing, say, in the 1990s, standing alongside the former spokesman for the Aryan Nations on a national atonement tour? I mean, that was when you went on this tour with Floyd Cochran. I mean, I think a lot, it's sort of easy to just presume in this day and age that an act like that would be seen as justifying or what's the word I'm looking for? Vagaries of live radio, but or just like giving credence to even the existence of the Aryan Nations, that you shouldn't even have stood next to him. And you did this whole national tour.
Well, of course, when Hate Groups Come to Town, which is the name of a book we wrote back then, most people in the town just want to ignore them. They want to pretend that if they ignore them, they'll just go away. Then there's a smaller segment that wants to fight them, which we always discouraged because we believed in nonviolence. And the middle section just was confused about what to do. But we felt that it's never a good idea to ignore hatred in your midst, because it just grows. But when Floyd called the Center for Democratic Renewal, where I was the program director, he asked, I want to speak to Leonard Zeskin. And of course, we were cautious because Reverend Vivian's house had been firebombed in the past and our office was in a basement, deeply secured. So I said, who's calling? And he said, Floyd Cochran. And I literally said, the Floyd Cochran? Because we'd been monitoring this guy for years. Mm-hmm. And so even though I had never met him, I knew his name. I knew he was the national spokesman for the Aryan Nation under Richard Butler. And so he said, yes, and I want to talk to Leonard. And so I just took a message and turned him over to Leonard, because obviously I was way in over my head. I was still astonished that I was on the phone with him. But it turns out that Floyd's child, second son, I believe, was born with a cleft palate. And his Aryan Nation buddies told him that his son was a genetic defect who needed to put to be put to death. And that was a wake-up call for Floyd. Floyd had been a Nazi since he was around 14 years old when he started wearing swastikas because he was getting bullied, and he made the people who bullied him afraid of him. And now he's in his mid-30s. He's too smart, so he's questioning some of what he's being told in the Nazi movement. And one of the things you can't do in a cult is ask questions. So he'd been kicked off the cult, kicked off the compound up in Hayden Lake, Idaho. And he was left homeless with very little skills because he'd been a Nazi since he was 14 years old. He was a great recruiter, though, and he was very knowledgeable about the Bible. And I think that's why he was so successful in recruiting skinheads. And so he was kicked off the compound. What CDR did at the time was kind of manage an informal underground railroad for people leaving the hate movement who didn't want to turn to the FBI and rat out their brothers or former comrades and seek witness protection. Mm-hmm. So we worked with a lot of churches across the country to help these people reintegrate back into society.
Okay.
But Floyd wanted to do more than just leave the Aryan Nations. He wanted to apologize, particularly because he had recruited these two brothers named Freeman in Allentown, Pennsylvania, who came home one weekend and murdered their entire family, the mother, the father, and their 12-year-old brother. And Floyd felt personally responsible for that because he had recruited these boys when they were like 16 and 18 into the Aryan Nation.
We just have to take a quick break. We're talking with Professor Loretta Ross about her efforts, her teaching now about calling in and combating the calling out culture. We'll hear a lot more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're speaking with Loretta Ross. She is visiting associate professor at Smith College, where she teaches a course on white supremacy, human rights, and calling in the call-out culture. And it's that last part about calling in the call-out culture, which, by the way, is the title of a book that Professor Ross has on the way next year, that we're talking about with her today. Now, so Professor Ross, in the previous segment, I heard quite a bit of your long career as an activist and really an activist against profound systemic injustices, white supremacy, state-sanctioned violence. But the calling out culture, though, can you define to me what you see calling out culture as that it is today?
Well, it's the tendency, which is unfortunate, for people to want to publicly shame and humiliate people. And it's based on what they say or what they look like or what they wear or who they're hanging out with or who they agree or disagree with. It's attaching labels to people without really doing any kind of nuance, without understanding that even if you disagree with someone, you shouldn't want to attack their humanity, call them a toxic person, or things like that. It's usually done most damagingly over the internet, mm-hmm. because social media amplifies and make all call-outs basically go viral immediately. And so instead of one person criticizing you, you end up with an angry mob who doesn't even know you that's criticizing you. And then I've seen careers and lifestyles and lives blown up behind this, because no one wakes up wanting to be the target of an angry bullying mob for something that may not have even been a mistake. It's maybe just a difference of opinion or a bad joke that went, you know, that didn't land right on somebody for any number of reasons. We're too quick to judge people based on what we think we know about them without doing any kind of research or homework.
Yeah. So there's a question, I think there's an important issue of proportionality here, right? Because, I mean, calling out the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan seems to be a completely legitimate thing to me. But you're talking about an entirely different milieu.
Yeah, I don't necessarily use my calling in techniques for people who would join the Klan. Mm-hmm. If they're still in the Klan, I've got a whole nother process for them. But I'm talking about people who we exhibit horizontal hostility towards. They're in the same group that we're in. They're in the same categories that we're in. Mostly we're just strangers on the internet. And I think too many people try to use the internet to form that social community that maybe they lack in life. And they find that they can get a lot of attention when they're vicious to others on the internet. And it becomes a sadistic festival of hatred that I think is just unnecessary. And I find also that a number of people who have indulged in the call-out culture through the toxicity of social media actually don't like who they've become once they, you know, spend their lives doom scrolling and it does nothing to make them happier. They actually regret what they've done.
Mm-hmm. So this idea of horizontal hostility is really interesting, because a little earlier you said that, you know, you were talking about white supremacist cults and how, like, when you're in a cult, you can't ask questions. I wonder if you see the pervasiveness of digital horizontal hostility as also making it hard for people who are within the same groups to ask questions.
Well, I have to say, calling out is not a partisan issue. It happens on the right. It happens on the left. It happens in the middle. And so I'm not going to claim that the left is more prone to it than the right. As a matter of fact, the right wing might have started it all with the Salem witch hunts and the cancellation of Harry Potter or whatever. But I'm a human rights activist, so of course I'm going to be most concerned about how we have to fight for human rights without violating people's human rights, because that's a contradiction. And so when we indulge in the call-out culture within our own movement, mainly because someone uses a word that we don't agree with, or they actually think that you should be focusing on the climate while I'm focusing on reproductive justice, while I'm focused on racial justice, you're really trying to turn a movement, which is many different people thinking different thoughts and moving in the same direction, into a cult, which is many different people thinking the same thought and moving into a direction. And so we are a movement. We're not a cult. So I describe as cult those places that don't allow dissent, that don't allow difference, that don't allow challenges, and don't even welcome critical skepticism.
So this is happening in a lot of places. What made you, what inspired you then to, like, actually bring calling outs opposite, calling in, into the classroom to teach about it?
Well, that's a kind of a long story. I'll shorten it as fast as I can. It all started with my grandson, because when he was 10 years old, I couldn't reach him by phone because he had his head always on the internet. And so he said, "Grandma, get on Facebook and that's the way you'll reach me." Of course, the minute I got on Facebook, he got off. He went on to Instagram or TikTok or wherever kids go. But anyway, I stayed on Facebook and noticed how much hatred there was just scrolling past my feed. So I asked one of the young organizers I was working with, Marissa Graciosa, "What's going on in this social media stuff?" And she said, "Oh, you mean the call out?" I said, "Y'all named it?" She said, "Oh, yeah." And she said, "Well," I said, "Well, what are y'all going to do about it?" And she just shrugged. I started thinking that as a activist with the 45-year career going through COINTELPRO, calling out gossip, trashing, we used to call it in the 70s. Matter of fact, the worst burn you could give in the 70s was someone to say, "You're not relevant." Mm-hmm. I mean, we used to do all of that stuff. So I thought I had something to offer to the intellectual commons about how we overcame and dealt with our call-out culture back then and how we can change today.
Did you overcome it?
Did I ever call out?
I mean, yeah. I mean, like when you say how we overcame call-out culture back in the day, was it ever really overcome fully?
Well, I think that we had the model. We had the model of the civil rights movement because they bitterly disagreed with each other. And they always found a way to present a united front outside of their disagreements. Reverend Vivian told me this, but when you live in Atlanta, you get to know all of these civil rights icons. And so I heard this in many conversations about the fights they would have behind closed doors and the united front they would present in the public. And so we had that model to go on. But also we found that too many people on the left, particularly in the 70s and 80s, were too caught up in their own little sectarian battles, all apparently following different dead white men and arguing a whole over which one of them were right. And I found that a bit ludicrous because I used to say, listen, y'all, do y'all realize that no matter how you think Lenin or Trotsky or Marx was right, the whole rest of the world see you all as communists. I don't know why you're spending so much time fighting amongst yourselves, and I never joined any of those groups because I thought that their practices were suspect and their analysis was a little weak because it didn't include race or gender. But at the same time, we had to overcome a lot of calling out, a lot of violence. Of course, it was during the days of COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program, whose job, whose aim under J. Edgar Hoover was to infiltrate all the organizations on the left, from the Black Panther Party to the Civil Rights Movement, the American Indian Movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, and the gay movement. And so we had to realize that when someone came in our midst and they were being just entirely too disruptive with the call out, then we needed to figure out whether they were just naive or really an agent provocateur.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That point well taken. There were bigger issues at stake than just the sort of internecine disagreement. So, okay, point taken. So let's get back into the classroom. I mean, I guess it's a virtual classroom, right? Because you're in Atlanta teaching students at Smith there. So let's get back into the Zoom classroom where you talk about call-out culture and combating it with calling in. So I want to just play a little bit of some video from the internet that you reference in your class about call-out culture.
This video is about canceling, also known as cancel culture, formerly known as call-out culture.
Okay, so that's Natalie Nguyen. She's a popular YouTuber. And Natalie posted a lengthy video about the features of cancel culture back on her page back in January.
Canceling is online shaming, vilifying, and ostracizing of prominent members of a community by other members of that community. You know, it started out as this vigilante strategy for bringing justice and accountability to powerful people who previously had been immune to any consequences for their actions. For example, the Me Too movement promised to use social media shaming to topple sexually abusive men in power who couldn't be held accountable any other way. The promise of canceling was that it was going to give power back to people who had none, and bring justice to prominent abusers.
So that's actually some important history about the initial impulses of canceling. But then Natalie Nguyen goes on to say, well, it's actually turned into something else. She uses the example of a feud between two beauty bloggers, Tati Westbrook and James Charles. And I'm not an expert on this, but apparently the feud is very long and detailed. But at one point, Westbrook posted a video making accusations against Charles about online vitamin companies and betrayal. And Westbrook also said that Charles tried to, quote, trick a straight man into thinking he's gay yet again. However, the headlines that emerged about the video said something entirely different.
I really don't think that he's a sexual predator is a fair summary of the accusation. So this seems to me like a pretty nasty and dishonest twisting of the story. And it happened instantaneously on Twitter. It totally dominated the conversation in a community of millions of people for weeks. In a few days, James had lost millions of subscribers, and who knows what effect it had on his personal life. Not that anyone seemed to care. In fact, most people seemed to be enjoying his downfall.
So the enjoying the downfall part is why Wynn says the beauty blogger's cancellation shows us that call-out culture has really transformed into something else.
It's, in a way, the 21st century version of the guillotine, the bringer of justice, the people's avenger. But also, like the guillotine, it can become a sadistic entertainment spectacle. And I want to make the case that we do have, well, a teensy bit of a reign of terror situation on our hands, Gorge.
So that's Natalie Wynn in a long, actually, explanation of call-out culture on the internet. Professor Ross, so then in your class, what do you teach about how you call in? What's the opposite of what Natalie Wynn was describing there?
Well, a call-in is actually a call-out done with love and respect, because you're really seeking to hold people accountable for the potential harm that they cause. But you're not going to lose sight of the fact that you're talking to another human being. And so you extend a hand of active love and active listening to help them maybe stop and think about what they said. You could say, I beg your pardon. Or when you said that, that didn't really land on me correctly. Can we talk about what's going on with you to make you do that? I mean, there's a whole bunch of things you can do other than, you should not say these things. You are using the wrong words. You're a transphobe. You're a racist. I mean, we could go all of that, right? Or you could just ask people to pause and rethink their words. Or maybe say, if somebody was here representing that community, would you say that to their face? And I really want to know what's going on with you that makes you want to say it from the beginning. As a matter of fact, I had a discussion yesterday in my class about the N-word. And the question, I'm going to repeat Ta-Nehisi Coates' thing, is not who uses it or why, but why would you want to use it in the first place? Mm-hmm. What's actually going on in your heart that's trying to justify a word that you know will wound somebody else? There's an intentionality about that wounding that you need to maybe rethink. Is that how you want to walk through the world, going around carelessly wounding others?
How do your students respond to this?
Oh, they love it because they're caught in a trap of feeling like they're walking around on eggshells, afraid to really say what's on their mind because they think their thoughts need to be perfect before they say anything. They shut down in a call-out culture because they're afraid that they'll be the next victim. And so they love it. And they're telling me, I don't even wait till I get home to start using this stuff. I'm using it already in my relationships with people, with my parents. I think calling in is going to be to the 21st century as a social justice practice what nonviolence was to the 20th century as a social justice practice. It's about teaching us how to be together in a different way, even with people we would call opponents.
So this summer, you were one of the signatories in a letter that was published in Harper's Magazine called A Letter on Justice and Open Debate. More than 150 people signed it, and it was about promoting the free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, and how that is being daily more constricted. Now, it came in a very volatile summer for the United States, and there was immediate pushback, Professor Ross. People basically saying that the calls for of more tolerance in society was exactly the tools that had been used against activists before, saying that you needed to be more civil, you needed to be more welcoming, and that it was a really misguided letter. What's your response to that?
Well, I'm going to say that there's never a time when I'm not going to protest against injustice, because we as human rights activists, that's what we do. We look at the ugliness of humanity and we raise our voices and protest against it. But I thought there was something really ironic in being called out for signing a letter on the call-out culture, that the people who challenged us perhaps missed that point. But really, they proved my point, that we really need to understand that in a pluralistic society, we have diversity, and handling that diversity through call-outs is not the best strategy.
Well, Professor Ross, stand by, because we've got a lot more to talk about what calling in needs to look like in 2020. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat the story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking with Loretta Ross. She is a lifelong civil rights activist, a reproductive justice activist, black feminist. She's a visiting associate professor at Smith College now in the program for the study of women and gender. And she's teaching a course on white supremacy, human rights, and calling in the call-out culture. Now, calling in the call-out culture is also the title of a forthcoming book from Professor Ross, and she's been talking to us about how in this course teaching this new culture of calling in, that students are really responding very well to it, because Professor Ross was saying how she's seeing her students say that they don't like being flattened down into one identity or constantly having to walk on eggshells regarding everything they say. Or in a feature about Professor Ross in the New York Times, one student was even quoted as saying she didn't know whether she could buy the sweatshirt of a band she liked in case that band was later on found to have done something unacceptable. So it's really interesting. So Professor Ross, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation Alicia Garza. She's the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement and author of The Purpose of Power: How We Come Together When We Fall Apart. Alicia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So I just want to – I'll get out of the way between the two of you, because I would love to hear the two of you talk. But I'm going to start off by just asking you this. You heard Professor Ross say just a couple of minutes ago that she believes that creating a culture of calling in will be as integral to the social justice movement of the 21st century as nonviolence was to the civil rights movement. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, Professor Ross is one of my heroes. And I 100% agree that, you know, in any generation, there are defining characteristics that really do determine which direction a movement may go. And it is quite possible that learning to call in may be to this generation what nonviolence was to the generation that precedes us. I guess I would offer, though, that I think one of the things that I would like to see in terms of what that pivotal moment might be is that, you know, that we actually expand our ways of building relationships between people. And I think that that is essentially what calling in is talking about, right? It's about asking more questions. It's about going deeper. It's about holding compassion. It's about seeing people as multidimensional beings and understanding that, you know, in the case of movements in particular, that part of what we're trying to do is build something that we haven't been successful in building before. And so we're doing that with human beings who are also inherently messy. And so therefore, as a result, the projects that we embark on in pursuit of our own liberation will also necessarily be messy as well. I think one thing that I do struggle with sometimes, though, is that I do, just like in our conversations about self-care, I do sometimes feel that our conversations about calling in or cancel culture actually flatline a little bit, because it essentially says, in some arguments, not in Professor Ross's argument, but in some versions of these arguments, we can kind of go to this place where it's like, everything is welcome, everything is okay, as long as we engage with it in a nice way. And I don't believe in that. I don't believe in that at all. And I don't think Professor Ross does either. In the same way, I don't believe that, you know, self-care is just about taking a bubble bath or making sure you take a break. That's not actually at all what we're talking about. And so, you know, the contours and the details here do matter. And I think that part of what we're struggling with right now is that so much of our communication that used to happen in rooms in person is now happening on technology platforms where we all get to hide behind avatars that we project our chosen qualities to the world, and we develop personas that may not be our own.
Yeah.
In a classroom or in an organization, it's different because you actually see people at their best and their worst. You see them when they have a cold. You see them when they have accomplishments in their lives. You see them when they have disappointments and challenges in their lives. And you're all in the same place at the same time. This era is a little bit different in that these platforms bring us together across geographies and boundaries, but they also allow us to live in a virtual reality that may skew what our responsibilities are to one another.
Yeah, no, I completely hear you on that, because I think we all have the responsibility of thinking both with nuance and with rigor, right? It's not all one thing or all the other. Completely agree. Mm-hmm. Professor Ross, I'm going to let you back in here for a second, but I just wanted to ask Alicia one more question that I'll get out of the way. We've heard a couple of times, and I think this is right, that the internet is one of the major problems here, because it increases the velocity of things and flattens at the same time. But I do wonder what you think about the fact that we're also seeing some of this in in-person relationships. I'll just give you an example. Like, I have witnessed a time or two, not on my current staff, but like within journalism, for example, when someone is defending a practice of journalism, and they are called out as defending white supremacy. Like, it's a white supremacist practice to fact check certain people or something like that. Like that. And I've that has happened. So I'm just wondering, like, how do you? I think that person, those people that at the time are trying to reclaim some power that they felt they did not have, and are trying to provide in good faith important critiques of the institutions of journalism. But it also still becomes like very one-sided. Like, there's no way to respond to that. There's no in to be called
I understand.
Into. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, you know, look, in debate practice, right? These are like gotcha moments, right? Where you knock your opponent off of their center. But I think there's a couple things that I see in situations like the ones that you're describing. You know, number one, it may very well be a white supremacist practice, but the intention, right, matters. The intention of the critique matters just as much as the substance does. And I want to say that in my experience, I think that one of the challenges that we have is that we actually lack institutions that help people think and engage critically, mm-hmm. And use frameworks correctly. And that leads to the tossing out of things as conversation stoppers, as opposed to allowing our observations to continue to add depth to a discussion. So, for example, it could be calling something white supremacist, it could be calling it anti-Black, it could be calling it transphobic. I mean, we could call a thing, but we also need to be able to engage in the struggle of, is that the appropriate container? And those kinds of skills, and they actually are skills, the skills to debate without taking it personally, the skills to struggle and have difference without and still remain connected, right?
Right.
These are skills that actually we don't teach in the academy largely, you know, because we do it from a place of everything is neutral, right? But for a lot of us, we don't live in neutrality, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the contradiction that we live in. But then on the other hand, and I appreciated Professor Ross's description of kind of how some of these dynamics would play out in organizations in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I would argue, of course, they continue to exist today. And we don't actually have a huge infrastructure of political organizations. We have a lot of infrastructure that is nonprofit organizations, which actually function by different sets of ethics and ethos. Those are more corporate entities that get used for political ventures, right? And I think actually some of these organizations that we were talking about before actually began as political organizations, and they may have, you know, raised money from, you know, nonprofit status or whatever, but it's the characteristics are different. Mm-hmm. And those trends, those lines of thought, you know, Professor Ross was talking about sectarianism, and certainly in political organizations, right? Your theory of change is the lens through which you see your work, right? And whether or not it is effective, whether or not it is getting you closer to the goal. And I lament that I think there are a lot of holes in our political infrastructure that would allow for a juicy and rigorous intervention in what we call cancel culture or call in culture or call out culture. And some of this is just about actually doing activism or social change work, or seeing any of our work, right, as political work that requires the strength of our relationships to be successful, not requires our agreement to be successful.
Right. Okay, so we've only got about 5 minutes left. I should have gotten out of the way a lot sooner, and I'm sorry. But so Professor Ross and Alicia, go ahead. Like, Professor Ross, what do you think about what Alicia's saying?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I'm in a mutual admiration society with Alicia. And please call me Loretta, because Professor Ross, I don't even require my students to call me that.
Okay, it's a deal.
Let's keep it real. And I want to say I teach your articles and your book in my class. So it's always an honor to be in conversation with you. That article on collaboration, it was magnificent. But I also wanted to speak to something you said about just letting everything slide as if it's neutral. And I want to bring into the conversation an Austrian scientist named Karl Popper, who in 1945 said, "Too much tolerance of intolerance will intolerance in our society." So you don't just allow those anti-democratic, racist kind of things to just take place and act like it's all neutral conversation. So that's not what I'm calling for at all. And I certainly do recognize that the people who are powerful are criticizing the call-out culture because they no longer are the only ones that can wield that weapon by punching down. They used to punch down on the powerless. But I really talk about how we're not necessarily using a proportional response when we're dealing with our comrades in the struggle, when we're dealing with people who have the same relative amount of power that we have. And of course, there's an overstatement of harm when people say, "I don't like your words," versus, "Your words make me feel unsafe." Mm. You know, those are two different emotions. And I was just going to close by saying that I'm so glad that I was educated in the 50s and 60s because I, too, was on the debate team. And I learned how to debate ideas and not people's personalities.
That's right.
And I think that art has been lost when we stripped most of our K-12 education through this whole neoliberal project, which I'm not going to go on about, of those types of vital skills that are about civics education, debate, what actually living in a pluralistic, multiracial, intergenerational society should look like.
That's right. That's right. You know, I couldn't agree with you more, Loretta. And honestly, one of the things that I think crosses generations is this desire for us to build emotional intelligence and curiosity as a skill for advancing our movements. And I have so many people who I love in my life who lament about the relationships that are still broken because there was some, you know, line struggle that happened 30 years ago that people never recovered from. But one thing that actually sticks with me a lot when I read your work and when I kind of hear all these conversations about cancel culture and call out culture and all the things is that, you know, a few years ago, I had the opportunity to travel to Mississippi for the 50th anniversary commemoration of the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And I was sitting around a table at Tougaloo College. Of course, we could talk a lot about the people who were in striped jumpsuits, the prison labor that the college was using for this event, which really got my head in a whole other place. But I was listening to some of the members talking about what happened before the split in the organization, right? Where, you know, white folks were essentially encouraged, I may be telling this story in a way people don't agree with, but you'll understand my point, to go organize white folks, right? And Black folks were wanting to make that institution much more Black focused. And to sit at that table literally 50 years later and hear the hurt and the pain coming in through those conversations reminded me that what is important for us today is to make sure that we all make it to the other side. Mm. And we won't. We won't if we torch the connections that will get us there. Yeah.
Well, Loretta, we have just one minute left here. And I'm coming back to this idea that I just want to close with one thing that, like, obviously very few of us will ever be able to take your class. And I'd like to give some of our listeners some tools. So what tools can you give us to help to navigate these times where, you know, to transform a call out culture into call in culture?
Well, actually, I decided that I didn't only want to teach the privileged students at Smith. So I started offering my class online for $5 a lecture at a very accessible way. And so people can write me, just Google my name and they'll find me and find the class. And the next one starts in January. But I just want to speak to one thing that Alicia talked about.
We've only got 30 seconds, Luther. I'm so sorry.
I'll just say, when Black folks tell white folks to go get your people, go talk to your people, that doesn't mean go talk down to your people.
Come on, tell the truth.
Well, Loretta Ross, thank you so very much for joining us today. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
And Alicia Garza, co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement and author of The Purpose of Power. Alicia, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.